Welcome to Mighty Parenting, the podcast with real, raw, and relevant talk about raising teens and parenting young adults. Here are your hosts, Judy Davis and Sandy Fowler.
Welcome to Mighty Parenting, a community where we help you raise teens and parent 20-somethings so they can become happy, successful, and emotionally healthy adults. I am Judy Davis, and I'm here with my co-host, Sandy Fowler. And today, we are talking education, learning, and how we can actually unlock our kids' potential. You know, out there in the Mighty Parenting land, if you have listened to us at all, you probably have a pretty clear understanding that Sandy and I have this ingrained belief that all of our kids are so strong and so resilient and so amazing. And every single one of them has unique talents and things that give them the potential to live wonderful and very full lives. And you might have even heard some of our information from our shows on learning styles and the math mindset. And you know that we believe the education system isn't perfect, that there are some problems with it and things that we can do as parents that can help our kids. So when we saw what John Couches was up to, we jumped at the chance to interview him. And I know, Sandy, you are so into this topic, so I'm excited about it.
Yeah, I know. I've been driving you crazy since I started reading the book, but it's given me a lot of hope, and it's given me some new perspectives. So as we interview John today, if you've been listening for a while, you might be able to pick up on some of the mindset shifts that I've had. And I think it's brilliant. I think it's interesting. And John has the background and the experience to really bring this idea to our society, to our culture. He has not only quite an educational and professional background, including bachelor's and master's degrees from University of California, Berkeley, positions at several major companies, including Hewlett-Packard and at Apple. He was in early at Apple, reporting directly to Steve Jobs, and went out and did a whole bunch of other amazing stuff, and then came back to be Apple's first vice president of education. But what's also interesting is he's also a parent. He's had to support his kids, even as some of them struggled with our current education system. So he really knows firsthand what that's like to watch your child have to do that struggling, have to work extra hard to find their way or to make it through the current system. And he's taken that knowledge. He also went out and worked at a school out in California. He was at the struggling Santa Fe Christian schools and helped them turn around. And they're one of the first examples of how we can revolutionize learning in the classroom with the creative use of technology. What he's done to share these ideas with the rest of us is written the book, Rewiring Education, How Technology Can Unlock Every Student's Potential. So we're going to tap into some of the ideas from the book and some of John's background. And John, we so appreciate you taking the time to join the Mighty Parenting community today.
No, it's my pleasure. Obviously, I have a passion for kids.
That comes through loud and clear.
Exactly.
Not only do I have four of my own, but I have 16 grandkids. And as you guys know, they're all unique. They're all individual.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And they all need different things from us, right?
Absolutely. They have different learning styles. They have different passions. They, even though they've grown up in the same home and the same demographics, they are unique.
That's so true. So true. Well, you know, John, you talk about changing the education system in a really unique way. And until we actually read your book, I assumed that you would suggest tossing out the whole system that we have and creating a new one. But that's not your premise at all. I'd love for you to share your thoughts on what you really mean when you say rewiring our education system.
Yeah, I guess, there's been two plan of attacks, obviously. One is to jettison the whole system and start over. And the other has been really what I would call a patching system, where, you know, we'll limit the classroom to 20 people. We'll do this. We'll do that. Patch, patch, patch. And neither one seemed to have changed anything. Our suggestion is really rewiring means that it's kind of a constant rewiring based on the challenges that society poses. So, you know, as you know, our educational system was really defined by an essay in 1912 by the Board of Education, which was funded by Rockefeller. And in a sense, they basically decided that what our schools needed to produce were individuals for the assembly line, where everybody would be the same and do the same. And that still seems to be, you know, the dominant mode in the classroom. It tends to be all based on memorization. You know, read chapter 5, answer the questions, the test is on Friday, and move on. The book was really written for the purpose of starting a conversation, to bring to the surface the fact that our education system, as good as it is for some people, is not meeting the needs of all individuals. And our society is moving from a standardized society, you know, with here's the well-worn footsteps to success, to a more personalized society. And so we call for a pedagogical framework that's not based on memorization, but one that's first and foremost relevant to the student. Secondly, that the students are capable of being creators, not just consumers of information. That working together, as Vygotsky has talked about, collaboration is a plus. Unfortunately, when I went to school, collaboration was called cheating. And every project was a single person project. So I never really got to benefit from my peers' uniqueness. And then finally, the pedagogy needs to be challenging. And all you need to do is look at the game world to see how important challenging is to individuals.
Well, and John, I want to kind of back up just a little bit too, to where you said, you know, this system doesn't work for all kids. And sometimes I think we get caught in the idea of, oh, the system isn't working for the kids who aren't getting good grades. But even for kids who are doing well within the current system while they're in school, many of them are struggling when they get out. So even though it appears to be working for them because they get good grades, they're not living well and working well in the world past the classroom.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. You know, we talk about the framework challenge-based learning, which is really, you know, a relevant, creative, collaborative, challenging framework. And it's interesting, in all the years of experience at Apple, the individuals that had the most difficulty with a challenge-based learning pedagogy were the honor students. Because, you know, their response was, tell me, teacher, what I need to do to get an A, and mm-hmm. I will do that. But when you ask them to solve a problem whose answers are not in the back of the book, they tend to panic. And the fundamental reason for that is we have taken creativity out of the classroom, totally out of the classroom. In fact, what's interesting to me is that kindergarten was invented, if you will, by Frederick Freibels in 1846 in Germany. And in fact, kindergarten means the garden of children for children. And his philosophy was that the children were created and therefore were creation beings, that they could create. And so his idea of kindergarten was about music, about nature, about movement. And the whole focus was on creativity. What's interesting is when kindergarten came over to the United States about the same time as that 1812 essay, Froebel's had created what he called the Froebel gifts, which were a series of 9 sets of blocks that the kids could build in abstract what they'd seen in nature. And so creativity was the essence for him. Today, NASA's test on creativity shows that 98% of 5-year-olds are creative, only 2% of adults. So what happened in that time frame? It was education. You know, Joe Ito at the MIT lab says, education is what people do to you, learning is what you do for yourself. And it's ironic because when these blocks, and they're not just blocks, in fact, they're still used at the Graduate School of Architecture at MIT, and they were a favorite of Frank Lloyd Wright. When they came over to the United States, Milton Bradley became the manufacturer of them, and what do? They put the alphabet on them. So kindergarten all of a sudden became all about literacy and not about creativity. And if you look at kindergarten today, it's not, it's much like elementary school. There's worksheets, and there's really no focus on extracting or releasing, if you will, the God-given talents that each child has. You know, I've taught at Cal Berkeley, I've taught at Cal San Jose State. I took 10 years of my life and rebuilt the Santa Fe Christian School. I never met a student who wasn't uniquely gifted in some manner. Mm-hmm. And I use my own kids as examples in the book. My son Jonathan dropped out of high school. He told me, he said, "Dad, I think in 3D. And well, if you can think about high school, there really isn't much other than maybe geometry, which turned out to be his best subject, that was 3D focused. Eventually, he was accepted to Savannah School of Art and Design and given a scholarship because his portfolio represented what they had hoped the students graduating would create. His first house design, he won the Dwell Award, and today he has his own architectural firm. And the fact that he thinks in 3D, the technology has caught up, so he can fundamentally design a house in 3D.
Mm-hmm. It's really interesting that you bring that example up, because I think that it really kind of puts a pinhole into what is some of the issues with our current system, is that they aren't seeing the value in thinking differently. And so that would just be like one of my observations about some of the shortcomings. What other things do you see are shortcomings of the current system?
Oh, well, geez, don't get me started on that.
We'll cut you off after five.
Yeah. Well, first of all, let me kind of put it under an overall umbrella, because Todd Rose, who you know, who wrote The End of Average, which is a great book, mm-hmm. Specifically talks about there's no such thing as average. And so he now runs, he dropped out of high school with a D minus average. He now runs the Individuality Lab at Harvard University. And he's written a new book called Dark Horses, where he talks about this transition from standardization to personalization. And that, you know, I think one of the first challenges is the role of the teacher should be to help the student, you know, locate, determine that unique gift that they have, tied with the passion that they have. I have a granddaughter who was studying to be a pre-med, did her internship this summer at Stanford University. Very, very, very bright by traditional standards. She could walk those well-worn footsteps, climb that ladder to be a pediatric doctor. After 1 year, she's decided that she's going to transfer to Savannah School of Art and Design and do fashion, because her passion is in fashion, even though she has the gifts, the scientific gifts, to be a doctor. And it's a kind of ironic that I was working with a fellow who was chartered at Johns Hopkins University Medical School to redefine the admission tests, because they find that people accept and attend medical school because their parents attended medical school or their grandparents attended medical school. And they will go through medical school only eventually not to be a doctor, because it really wasn't their passion. But if you want to talk about specific things in schools, which I think are challenges for us, I can certainly do that.
Definitely. I would love to hear you.
It helps us. You know, as parents, we're not in the school system. We're getting information from our kids. And so the more we understand about what's happening, the better able we are to help our kids and to help guide our school systems, work with our teachers and our principals and our school boards.
Yeah. Well, I think first and foremost, we need to realize that this is a generation of students who've grown up with technology. Alan Kay once said, technology's only technology to those born before the technology. And I think that's number one. We need to recognize that the students are capable of doing much more than the current curriculum allows them to do. In fact, I donated some iPads to three schools in Ghana, Africa, where you have middle school kids sitting on dirt floors who are now programming in Swift and flying drones. And the administration of the school came to the realization that their curriculum wasn't challenging enough, that the kids were capable of much more than the traditional standardized curriculum. So I think that's one, to recognize that students are different. And they process information differently than we do. Their brains are wired differently than ours were. I think the second thing is that, Ruben Putendera, who was the consultant for the Maine Learning Initiative, which was Governor King and now Senator King's initiative back in 2002 to give every seventh grader an iBook. And he talks about the use of technology, and he said, technology can be used as a substitution, or it can be an augmentation, modification, and finally redefinition. And unfortunately, majority of technology today in the classroom is used in a substitution arena. Instead of accessing content in a book, we're accessing content off the internet. We're not really empowering the students to be creators of their own content and solving problems that have yet to be solved. So that's one. We need to elevate the use of technology in the classroom. And so you get a lot of naysayers and say, well, look, we've had computers for 10 years and it hasn't made any difference. But, that's like saying I bought a car, but I'm pushing it. I'm not stepping on the gas. I think that we have to change the pedagogy in the classroom, as we've talked about. We've got to move from memorization to something like challenge-based learning, where it's relevant to the kids, that they're driving it. It's challenging. I use two examples in the book. One is, is my water safe to drink? That's the way you'll learn about the periodic chart and the elements and what elements make up water, and that there are carcinogenic elements in the water, but who decides what's safe and what's not. It's an entirely different learning environment. I use the example of California history in the book because in California, everybody in fourth grade needs to take California history. And all the teachers have to go on really is the textbook, and the publishers put the minimal amount in the textbook to get it adopted by the state. And so almost every one of my kids had to build a mission, right? And, I tell people, if the mission comes in anything other than sugar cubes, the parents probably had a hand in it, unless it comes in Minecraft. And then the student did it, right? And right. So the challenge for California history would be something like this. You're William Randolph Hearst. Well, who's William Randolph Hearst? Well, you need to discover that. I'm not going to distribute that information to you. You're going to discover that William Randolph Hearst was the owner of the San Francisco Examiner, that he built Hearst Castle, which was a combination of materials and people and animals from all over the world. So all of a sudden you're getting outside of California, and that he entertained the Hollywood elite every weekend on a long table for dinner. Your challenge is, you're going to invite the individuals who made the biggest impact in California history. Who would you invite, and what would the seating chart look like? Right?
So you give them the ability to put into practice some problem-solving skills. Exactly. They have to research it to get it. So they actually integrated learning is what
you said. In a team, right? In a team. So you benefit from other people's expertise. One of my favorites, and I put it in the book, was Jody Domheimer in Coppell, Texas, where she taught 11th grade anatomy. And she was looking for a learning activity, and the students said, well, why don't you let us build it for you? And then the students decided that, hey, why don't we create our own course and our own book for the younger kids? And so that became their project. And the young girl who was assigned to do the illustrations, and remember, these are illustrations for second and third graders, was not considered to be a very good student. Today, she's a medical illustrator because it was the experience in that project, in that challenge, that got her to realize, you know, where her talent was and where what got her excited. And I thought about, what course did I take in high school that would have even given me an indication that there was an opportunity to be a medical illustrator? And I think you can take that example and expand it into 100,000 of different jobs.
Right. Well, at this moment, you know, the education system isn't doing that. And as a parent, I go, this sounds incredible. This will be so empowering to my children and helping them get back to that place where they're thinking and instead of just memorizing. What can we do as parents to nurture this until we have a different education system?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's two things I want to mention there. One is, you can, you know, we've got to take the time and allow our kids to be creative. We've got to allow our kids to fail. That's another, I think, flaw in our education system. We don't allow for failure, you know? And when you don't allow for failure, you're not going to be very innovative. You're not going to be very creative. You're going to follow the well-worn footsteps. So I wrote with Jason, who's at Harvard, the first book, Rewiring Education, to start a conversation. We are now in the process of the second book called Education Rewired, which are sample schools all over the world that are rewiring, that are doing it differently. So it will empower the parents with specific examples of what's happening around the world that's changing education. So you'll be able to say, well, you know, geez, my school doesn't have a 3D lab. My school doesn't have this. You know, this school is doing some very, very unique things. They've done away with grades and they've replaced them with portfolios. And so we're hoping that the second book, which will be case studies of maybe 50 different schools around the world that are rewiring. And of course, it comes down to leadership, right? You've got to have somebody in the school that believes in the students, that understands that, you know, that schools were created for students and that they should be creating a powerful learning environment for those students. And you can create a vision, a shared vision between the teachers, the parents, and the community to make the appropriate changes. Unfortunately, you know, we have school boards, and school boards are tend to be elected with an agenda. And we don't give our principals or superintendents the time that it takes to really usher in change.
So from that standpoint, there's kind of two pieces to the what can we do. One is helping, as I hear you say, helping to usher in the change by talking to our school administration, maybe go to some school board meetings, but also talking to other parents about these ideas so that we're encouraging them and that we're supporting and encouraging steps along the way. It might not be that we can go from where we are right now to the final goal in one step. There might be other things we have to do along the way, but these ideas of not only classwork, but outside clubs and activities and organizations, like the robotics clubs, remind me, when I was reading the book, they remind me of that type of a system. The kids have a challenge. They work together as a team, and there are adults who support them, but it's their project. It's their work, and they're doing every aspect of it. They have to figure out how to do the marketing. They have to figure out how to get the money. They have to figure out all the pieces beyond just building the robot. Plus, they have to have the robot work.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, you're absolutely right. Every long journey starts with a single step. I do not believe that education is going to change top down. I believe it's going to change bottom up as the parents become more aware of alternative schools like the ones we're covering right now. I was just recently in Rancho Santa Fe, which is a, you know, a wealthy area in North County, San Diego, with a group of parents who, you know, it wasn't that they were dissatisfied with school there, but they knew that their kids were capable of so much more than the school was offering. And so, you know, when they approached, in fact, they actually bought my book and gave it to the superintendents and the principals just to start a conversation to say, well, why aren't we doing some? Where's our 3D maker lab? You know, where's our video production facility? What kinds of challenges can, you know, instead of lecturing, let's go to a more blended environment where the material is available online and then the classroom becomes more of discussion and problem solving, with the teacher being sort of a parallel, if you will, to the student, in, because she doesn't know whether the water is safe to drink. And so they work together solving a problem that the kids are interested in, which makes it automatically relevant. So I think that's one of the big differences between project-based learning and challenge-based learning, is in project-based learning, the teacher picks the project. In challenge-based learning, the student picks it. And so, guess what? They always pick something harder.
So, John, I have a question talking from the teacher perspective. Our teachers are taught in college how to be a teacher. And then they go into a district and they're given the curriculum, they're given this, and with standards that are imposed upon them by the districts and the school boards and things like that. So to me, my question is, how can you change a system from the bottom up or from within if we are teaching to tests, if we are teaching to the curriculum that's handed down, and that's the expectation of the teacher's position, you know, how does that hold
in? I think one of my favorite books is Todd Rose's book on End of Average. And what he points out in that book is that any institution that's based on the concept of average is doomed to fail. Our education system right now is based on the concept of average. In fact, you know, one of the examples in the book is a fifth grade class in Chicago, Illinois, where you have one student reading at the eighth grade level, one student reading at the first grade level, six different reading levels. The time that it would take the teacher to find the appropriate material for those six different levels is more than 40 hours a week. So in my mind, we have a built-in flaw in our system that we are not enabling individualized learning. And that's where I think technology can come in, because I've done studies with a company called eSpark, where eSpark vetted all of the educational apps in the App Store, tied them to the Common Core, looked at the results of the Northwest Educational Test, and said, Johnny doesn't understand quadratic equations, so we're going to give him this app, and he's going to spend 1 hour a day in that app, and at the end of the week, he's going to create something, whether it's a podcast, a video, a presentation, keynote presentation, to show his mastery of the material. And the test scores went from Northwest Educational Test says a 70% is college prep. The test scores went from 29% of the students who were college prep to 68% in one semester by delivering the exact learning activity that they need. So that's one of the challenges. We need to enable individualized learning. We're going to have to empower and upgrade the role of the teacher rather than a member of a union. They're professional. They're going to need ongoing professional development. When you look at the technologies that are coming down the road with augmented reality and blockchain, they're going to have a better understanding how they're going to impact the classroom. We've talked about a new set of ABCs, you know, A being access. We've got to give access to the students. I was on President Obama's Connect Ed committee, where the goal was to bring internet access to every school in the United States. Apple invested $100 million in 114 schools in 29 states, where it was 96% free and reduced lunch. So these were some of the poorest schools. B, you know, I think it's built. I think every student has the ability to build something, to create something. And C is coding. And not for coding's sake, but the process, the learning process in coding is the same learning process in challenge-based learning, and it's the same process if you're starting a company. You're solving an unknown problem. And that's why I think, you know, that's a better set of ABCs than, you know, obviously you need literacy and to read, but, you know, times are changing.
It was, again, going back to this place of mindset shift and hope that I mentioned at the beginning, a couple of things I wanted to talk about, because I think that our attitude, of course, also affects our kids. And one of the things that's happened for myself since Judy and I started doing these Mighty Parenting podcasts is I, of course, have learned a lot from our guests, and I've had some amazing conversations with my kids. But one of the interesting things that happened is, well, I've always supported them, even in things where I said, I hear what you're saying and I believe you, and I still supported them. There was a big shift once I understood why they felt the way they did about things and why they thought the way they did about things. And so reading this book helped me to understand our kids better. And you talk about them being digital natives. You mentioned that earlier that, you know, these kids have grown up with technology. They function differently, and they literally have their brains wired differently than we do. And I think that's an important concept for us as parents to understand. So, John, I wondered if you could explain a little bit of that. Because as parents, you know, we talk about things like, well, should our kids even have cell phones in school? Because yeah. There's so many issues that aren't about the education piece of it. It's the social issues that come up. And so if you can help us understand more about the kids, I think that would be good.
Well, first and foremost, you know, this is an age-old conversation about technology, right? Technology can be used for good, or technology can be used for bad. And so, you know, part of the responsibility that falls on us as parents is to ensure that the technology is being used in a positive manner. And that's, there are many different ways to monitor that and to ensure that's the case. I remember when the first handheld calculator came out, the HP 35, cost $400. All it did was add, subtract, multiply in reverse Polish. My father-in-law bought it. My dad said, well, I'm going to wait for the next one. 5 years later, my dad's still waiting for the next one. And my father-in-law had bought every one of them, right? So, but like I said, we haven't used technology to its fullest potential. And that's, that's a learning environment for parents as well. You know, are they using the technology simply to do social media? Or are they using the technology to do the research, to solve problems that haven't been solved?
And opportunity, right? You know, so when you said it can be used for good or for bad, my light bulb moment was, so we want to encourage our kids to use it for good. Well, one way to encourage them is giving them opportunities. And it takes me back to the example of the school that had a couple of computers that they shoved in the closet.
So
you want to share that story for people who obviously haven't read the book yet? They need to hear that story.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting because that story actually ties all the way back to 1846 when Froebel said kindergarten ought to be creative. I'm going to create some tools called the Froebel gifts, i.e. blocks, etc., to empower these students. In 1978, when I met Steve Jobs, his vision for Apple was basically that we have the ability to build tools to amplify our intellect, not to take us where we've already been, but to create and to be innovative. And so I donated the first two Apples, if you will, to a small Catholic school in Los Gatos in 1978. They had no idea what to do with them. So they cleaned the janitorial closet out, they put the two Apples in there, and they told the kids free time. You can use it before school, recess, after school. And what was ironic is what the kids did is what they were interested in. And one young boy who wasn't reading yet was really interested in games, and it was the process of playing the games that taught him how to read. Now, when the end of the year came and the kids had to vote for their favorite class, they voted the janitorial class, all right? Which tells you something about school, right? Boring, all right?
Yeah.
And so the eighth grade students said, well, we're going to donate another, I remember it was four or six Apple IIs. And now the school had a dilemma because six Apple IIs didn't fit in the janitorial closet. So they decided to make it an official class. They hired somebody's mom, ex-IBMer, to teach the class. And I saw the first exam the following year, and it was the front page of the manual with certain words blanked out that they had to fill in. And I wrote a paper called How the Apple Was Lost on the Way to School. And the premise was that Steve's vision for the apple was that of a mental bicycle. In the same way a bicycle amplifies our physical ability, he saw technology amplifying our intellectual and creativity ability. And if we weren't careful, our institutions would turn Steve's concept of a mental bicycle into an exercise cycle, something that's boring and doesn't go anywhere. And there's still some truth to that to this day.
Mm-hmm. So we want to be starting to think about and look at technology as exactly that. It is a tool that amplifies our kids' intellect.
Yeah, I would even go one step farther.
Okay.
It's an environment that amplifies one's intellect. So if you look at the TPAC model, which the academic research, that was one of the other challenges that we haven't mentioned, and that is we really haven't integrated the academic research into our schools, whether it's how the brain works, or the TPAC model, which says that there's a symbiotic relationship between technology, content, and pedagogy. What do schools do? They go out and buy a $200 box, and they never change the content, they never change how it's used in the pedagogy in the classroom, and they expect a different outcome. And what happens is technology is given a bad name, not because of the technology, but because we didn't use it appropriately.
So that's another place that as parents, we can be involved here. Is I know that school districts around us have been spending a lot of money on technology in recent years. And when we don't necessarily see the result or when parents are talking about it, we can change the conversation to say, well, how can this be used? How can this environment be used for our kids to be more creative and to solve problems? And we can have some patience with the school district rather than going back and scream and say, you guys wasted money, can't have any more money. Say, how can we train our staff and our teachers to really utilize this?
Yeah, I think there's a, sort of a cyclic relationship there, a symbiotic relationship. And it's very easy to look at a school and say, well, gee, you bought a box, but you didn't change how, the box is simply used to access content off the internet rather than content out of a book. We really need to create a different learning framework that takes advantage of the technology.
Mm-hmm. And it's almost like having and helping our kids understand that the computer is much more than the World Wide Web. It is a tool as opposed to just a thing to make our lives easier.
Yeah, again, I think it's more of an environment.
Why don't you talk about that a little bit, John? Help us understand.
They need to see it as basically a studio. They have their own studio. They have the ability to produce a movie, music, whatever it is, projects. They have an audience out there with the internet. They have the ability to get feedback from the audience. So there's an ecosystem there in a learning environment. And I guess what I'm saying is when you look at a lot of schools, they don't view it as an environment. They don't view it as an ecosystem. I was just in Kenya on a panel with the ministry there, And, you know, they were saying, okay, well, the two pedestals for going forward in Kenya are education and manufacturing. But they didn't understand how the two relate to each other. And so they're missing the point that manufacturing is going robotic, and there's nothing in the educational system that is preparing their students for that new manufacturing world. In other words, they're disconnected. Mm-hmm. And a lot of use of technology in our schools is disconnected, mm-hmm. right? I mean, the kids have more functionality in their social environments to communicate, to collaborate, to produce than they do in the school's learning environment. And so I think as parents, this is what we need to bring this to the surface. We need to support, you know, the one teacher in the school, because this is how it started. I just visited a school recently, and there's one math teacher there that got formed a foundation to fund blended learning and technology in the classroom with challenge-based learning for the students. Subsequently, seven other teachers have joined him and been trained by him. And so it's starting from the bottom. It's not starting from the top. And what happens, of course, is the parents and the kids in those classrooms get pretty excited. And then the other parents go, well, how come they have that and my son doesn't? You know, or my other son, who's in a different grade, doesn't get to take advantage of this new learning environment that's being created. You know, I just spoke to Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos, for about 90 minutes. And her right-hand person had attended a talk that I had given. And, you know, I talked about the potential of students, the uniqueness of students, the curiosity of the younger kids that somehow gets layered with concrete over time. And the next morning, I met Betsy, and she picked me up and said, you know, after listening to you last night, I changed the way I parent. And I go, really? What? She goes, well, my son was asking me something before dinner, and he was really curious. And normally I would just ignore him or say, we'll do this later. And later the passion and enthusiasm goes away. She says, I stopped and I attended to my son and to his creative needs. She says, you've changed the way I've parented.
So I think that's the key takeaway that I, you know, getting all the foundation, the key takeaway that you gave me is, I, as a parent, the best thing I can do is to nurture that curiosity immediately when it happens and facilitate using technology to interact and engage in a way that
exploration, right? Allow them to explore, allow them to fail. You know, the other story in the book was my youngest son, when he was in sophomore in high school, and he came home and said, Dad, I need to do a science project. And I go, yes, I know you're in biology. You need to learn about the scientific method. What are you interested in? And he goes, well, I've been reading about frogs that have been found with multiple legs. He says, I'd really like to understand what's causing that. You know, and I had to caution him that, well, that's not something the teacher knows. And it's probably going to be very difficult to find a book in the library. You might be able to find some scientific papers. What are you going to do? And he says, well, I'm going to go to the internet. And I said, okay, come back and let me know what you found. And he came back and he goes, I found three premises. One is ozone layer depletion, ultraviolet light zapping the frog, thereby causing a third leg. Pesticides in agriculture land washing down into a pond, therefore impacting the frog, and a parasite that a professor in a junior college in upstate New York found in one of these frogs with three legs. And I said, well, you know, what are you going to do? He says, well, I'm going to email the professor in upstate New York to see if I can get if he can show me where I can find a frog with the parasite, extract the DNA of the parasite, and compare it with known protein in limb generation. And as a parent, my first reaction was, one, you can't do that because I don't know anything about it. And two, you may fail. And if you fail, there goes college, right? And that's why I like Todd's new book, because Todd's new book says there's a shift from the standardization, the way that we've thought all of our life, to, you know, purposeful living by following our passion. And anyway, he did the study. He won the science fair. He got asked by Stanford University, Doug Brutlag, to come in and spend the summer continuing his research. And he said, no, you know, I play basketball in the summer. But, you know, but the point is, these kids are capable of so much more.
Yeah.
So much more. In fact,
the current system is holding them back almost.
Yeah. In fact, in Todd's book, he actually tells a little bit of my story, because he said, well, here was John, and he was accepted to the highly regarded graduate school of computer science in 1969. And he did all his coursework, he did all his prelims. When it came time to do the dissertation, they wanted him to do the dissertation on proving problems correct. And he was more interested in user interface and, you know, human user interface and computers. So he dropped out. 3 years later, he met a fellow by the name of Steve Jobs, who needed to solve the problem of user interface and personal computers.
And we all thank you for doing
that. Well, you know, the point there was I could have stayed on that trail, climbing those ladders, because that's what society was defining to be successful. Instead, I followed what my gut interests were, and guess what? There was a need in society for it. And so this, I think, is the problem, because, you know, when I went to college, I just viewed college as you're just trying to prepare me to be a professor. Not everybody's going to be a professor, but that's what our colleges tend to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this is, like I said, this has had some definite mindset shifts for me, and is going to change the way I'm parenting. I just finished the book. you know, the day we're recording it, I actually finished the last chapter this morning, but it did. And it's interesting because it still kept me on track with the core things, Judy, that you and I talk about in Mighty Parenting, that as parents, we need to live curiously. We need to be communicating with our kids, but communicating being shutting up and listening and letting them solve problems and make mistakes and do things, just be there, letting them know that we support them. And I'm hearing the same thing here. We have some issues with our education system. So as parents, it's more important than ever that we take those same principles and we put it to everything our kids are doing. We encourage their natural curiosity. We encourage anything that they have a passion about. As Betsy DeVos said, drop everything when that comes up and follow through with that moment. There was a book.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. And I think one of the things we have to be careful as parents is, you know, we may not have a clear vision of the future. You know, if we're continually walking in well-worn footsteps, and those footsteps are 10 feet deep, we don't see the environment. We don't see where that future leads. And so we have to be open. You know, I was on the board with Steven Spielberg at one time, and he said, geez, I thought his dad. And he goes, we thought little Steve would never be successful because all he wanted to do was go to the movies. Okay. And there's story after story after story like that. So, you know, and I think this is really true in families where, you know, everybody's an engineer or everybody's a doctor, and, you know, the expectation is Junior is going to follow in my footsteps. But, you know, Junior may be interested in astronomy. And, you know, we need to encourage that. In fact, I just sent a telescope to a 10-year-old because he's totally into astronomy. And I think that's the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so that was another thing you told us. You'd help our kids find their unique gifts and tie it to their passion. As a community, we can start these conversations, talk to other parents, take these ideas to our school boards, ask our teachers at back to school night, what kinds of challenge-based learning systems are you using? How are the kids getting to take control of things? If we're in a school system that has purchased the technology. Hey, what kind of support are you giving our teachers for understanding how to actually use this?
Yeah, are you even using it beyond the substitution mode?
Right. Mm-hmm. So, John, we're obviously in our show notes, we'll put in links to Todd's books. We will, of course, have a link to your book. You also have a great website that people can visit. Would you share that with us?
Yeah, you know, there's, I think one of the industries that's still married to the past is publishing. So what we were not able to do in the book, original goal in the book was those videographs, those pictographs at the beginning. We wanted to just put our phone over that and have those transfer to more information. Because we weren't allowed to put graphs and charts and you know, really any of my slides in the presentation that I give all over the world. So we tried to put those into a website called rewiringeducation.com. And in addition to that, I'm running a not a contest, but an award right now. I've got about 150 submissions from teachers who are sharing what they're doing in the classroom that's innovative. And the winner gets a iPad for the entire classroom and a trip to California to meet myself and Waz. I'm constantly looking for examples of creative thinking in the classroom that we will share with our audience, our parents, in the next book.
And the website again, can you share that with me?
Rewiring Education, rewiringeducation.com.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much for joining us today and being part of the Mighty Parenting community. And if you are a new listener, we would love for you to go to mightyparenting.com to check out all that we have to support you and visit John's website to see all that he has to support you as well. Remember, you are a mighty parent, and this is Judy Davis and Sandy Fowler saying have a great week.